Welcome to the PRI Review, brought to you by the Population Research Institute. I'm your host, Christopher Mannion. Today we look at charter schools, school unions, and the educational goldmine offered to families by Humanae Vitae. Then we hear from Father Bevel Bramwell, OMI, about the current state of the culture war and how it affects the church. And finally, we look at a great saint, Damien the Leper, and the attacks on his legacy by a cheap con artist in Congress. All this today on PRI Review. Hoover Institution scholar Thomas Sowell has written 8 books since he turned 80. He's got a lot of thoughts about education, and today we begin by listening to his views on charter schools. As long as blacks vote automatically for Democrats, he says, while the teachers' unions insist on getting their money's worth, it is all but inevitable that the education of black children will be sacrificed in the public schools wherever Democrats are in control. Well, last week, the Washington Examiner carried an important education analysis from the Center for Educational Reform. Carolyn Mannion and Center President Jean Allen said that as school systems are struggling to manage the myriad challenges of reopening, the American Federation of Teachers Union President Randy Weingarten announced that her union had approved teacher strikes. Now, of course, they're only a last resort, she insists, to protest school reopening plans that don't meet the union's self-serving agenda. This threat won't help teachers and students hoping to venture back to school, whether remotely or on the ground in the classroom. Now, these so-called safety strikers will insist that they're protecting public schools, but all they do is place millions of students at risk, the authors argue. While districts in different locales deal with varying pandemic conditions, students are threatened with the prospect of not receiving education indefinitely. Meanwhile, National Education Association affiliates, now that's the other big government school union in the country, marched against opening schools, attacking governors who are working to help get teachers and students back to class safely. They are demanding that concessions be made regardless of whether schools are preparing for in-person or remote learning, including getting rid of charter schools. That's their number one goal, because it's the competition, which have been working throughout the summer to open on time and prepare to offer a number of educational approaches. Well, good for them. Good for the Center for Educational Reform. They're fighting for families, for parent power, and for flourishing children. The unions make it clear, both of them. They're fighting for their members. If the kids want us to represent them, they gloat, tell them to join the union. Hear that, kids? Mom and Dad? So a coalition of 10 teachers' unions and the Democratic Socialists of America is demanding an entire laundry list of their agenda. Ban the new charter schools. Ban private school choice. Ban standardized tests that won't show them up naturally as poor performers. Demand police-free schools. That's going to invite a real peaceful atmosphere for learning, I'm sure. More federal funding. And now they've held a national day of resistance on August 3rd. All over the country. Towns from Baltimore and Baton Rouge to Cincinnati and Nashville, Orlando, Philadelphia, San Antonio. It's ridiculous. But they are demanding no reopening at all. And they're marching to make sure that they get their way. All schools have to be supported to function as community schools with adequate number of counselors and nurses and community parent outreach workers. Now watch here closely. They want to ban the charter schools. They want all schools, theirs, to have more union members and given all sorts of administrative titles, and these people will never see the inside of a classroom. Oh, they want safe conditions, lower class sizes. By the way, it's been proven that that doesn't help. They want cleaning, testing, protocols, equitable access, and all the rest. They want a moratorium, naturally, on any charter or voucher programs and no standardized testing. They want a massive infusion of federal money to support the reopening, and they want to fund it by taxing those billionaires and, of course, Wall Street. Well, folks, at least we have here the curtain pulled back on the radical politics that have infected the teachers' unions and our taxpayer-funded government schools for over a generation. You wonder why a third of today's millennials support socialism? It's because they've been taught by socialists. You know, the teachers are so adamant in their support of Democrats who are pro-union, and the unions are pro-Democrat. The kids get left sitting by the side of the road, that they become victims of their own propaganda when it comes to the virus. Of course, they have to beat the drum on the virus because that's Trump's problem, and that's going to be the reason that they can defeat Trump in November. But now they've become so infected by their own propaganda that they're all scared of going back to school. After this charade, teachers who don't want to go to work shouldn't get a check. They should get an F, because they certainly deserve a failing grade. You don't think it's political? Take a look at this. Last Friday, Montgomery County Health Officer Dr. Travis Gales, an unelected bureaucrat in Montgomery County, Maryland, issued a mandate that said, at this point, the data does not suggest that in-person instruction is safe for students or teachers. End quote. Okay, so far so good. He's a government bureaucrat. The school unions in Montgomery County are, for all practical purposes, government worker unions. And they don't want to go back to work. Fine. Public schools will be closed and parents will just have to get their money back and use it to pay someone else who will educate their children. And who better to do that than the private sector, through private schools, parochial schools, homeschooling co-ops, and all the rest? But the radical school unions are among the most obstinate in the country. They know better than to close their doors while other doors are open. So Dr. Gales, who is the health department employee, demands that all non-public schools be forced to close as well, because it was necessary to protect the health and safety of Montgomery County residents, he says, during the coronavirus pandemic. That means to protect the school unions. Well, fortunately, Maryland has a sane governor. On Monday, Governor Hogan said that private and parochial schools deserve the same opportunity and flexibility to make reopening decisions based on public health guidelines. The blanket closure mandate imposed by Montgomery County was overly broad and inconsistent with the powers delegated to the county health officer, said Hogan, undoubtedly with a wry smile. Governor Hogan's no-nonsense decision saved Washington Archbishop Wilton Gregory from having to take a stand himself. He's not known for doing that. The archdiocesan schools, after all, in Maryland would have been closed down too. Well, let's hope the archbishop will thank Governor Hogan, at least privately, for getting him off the hook. We'll be talking a lot about education in coming weeks because school is on everybody's mind. You're listening to the PRI Review from the Population Research Institute at pop.org. We'll be right back. A new challenge and opportunity for parents. Going to school used to be pretty routine, but it's an uncertain prospect these days. Amidst the widespread uncertainty, many parents are discovering a new dimension of their God-given vocation as their children's first teachers. Holy Mother Church has defended this parental role for centuries, and she reaffirms it once more in Vatican II's Declaration on Christian Education. Parents who have the primary and inalienable right and duty to educate their children must enjoy true liberty in their choice of schools, the Church Fathers taught. As the sexual revolution raged, St. John Paul was a faithful defender of parents. As we faced, as parents, the secular culture's assaults on the family. In Familiares Consortio, John Paul highlights the Church Fathers' emphasis of not only the rights of parents, but also their responsibility. Since parents have conferred life on their children, they have a most solemn obligation to educate their offspring. Hence, parents must be acknowledged as the first and foremost educators of their children, and their role as educators is so decisive that scarcely anything can compensate for their failure in it. End quote. Well, in embracing that noble task, today's parents face a host of unknowns. Children no longer simply go to school at the end of summer. Even where school takes place can be a matter of intense debate. But among the cloud of uncertainty, parents have the opportunity to fulfill their obligation in a new and creative way. Whatever the teaching arrangements, distant learnings, in-school classes, micropods, family-shared small group classes, or traditional homeschooling, mom and dad now have a better view of what Professor Anthony Esselin calls a simple but vital question. We want to know not only what's being taught, but what isn't being taught, he asks. When something is taught wrong, we can make it right. And when something crucial isn't taught at all, mom and dad can now fill in the blanks. In these troubled times, that duty is crucial. In recent years, the public schools have become increasingly secular. But lately, they've been going for broke. They now feature programs that not only offend good taste, but violate common decency and all too often violate the Ten Commandments, especially those addressing sexual morality. Education cannot be neutral about morality. If schools aren't teaching our children to respect the laws of nature and of nature's God, they are teaching them to break them. It's that simple. In fact, right now, a powerful faction of educational and cultural so-called leaders is working to force every government school pupil at every grade level to have his face rubbed in the most squalid and base sexual behaviors, all in the name of diversity. And while some children are fortunate enough not to be oppressed by that sordid curriculum, they can hardly escape being exposed to or even surrounded by children who are. That sad reality calls on us to respond to the challenge all the more forcefully, and we can do it most effectively in the family. Children raised to respect the gifts of modesty and purity in the home learn by experience. They will acquire the moral and spiritual habits that will dispose them, naturally, to welcome the beauty of God's teaching on marriage and family when they are grown. Confronted with the intensifying public opposition to morality and even civility, the call to make the family home a place of peace and holiness is all the more important. As Esselin puts it, we can teach the sheer beauty of what we believe and what our Christian cultures have bestowed upon the world when we are in the home. Now, at PRI, we offer families encouragement and support to sustain them and their family in their divine calling to teach the next generation. That's why we have devoted an entire website to the truths of Humanae Vitae and the rich spiritual and intellectual tradition that surrounds it at humanaevitaeproject.org. You will find papal documents, articles, studies, teaching aids, and lively discussions addressing the beauty and dignity of married love. We encourage parents to defend their right to be the first and foremost educators of their children. Today, financial and political circumstances deny many parents the true liberty in their choice of schools that the Church Fathers defend. Where we do enjoy that liberty, it is constantly threatened. Whatever the political and social conditions, we can exercise that liberty most freely in the home, and that is where saints are raised. Well, now let's hear from another longtime educator, Father Bevel Bramwell, OMI, longtime undergraduate dean at Catholic Distance University, author of many books, and a wonderful friend and commentator. The Cultural Revolution and Us, he wrote in The Catholic Thing this past week. The United States is currently going through its own version of China's Cultural Revolution, he says, including rampaging mobs, hell-bent on the destruction of property and historical artifacts. These disturbances has obscured the sometimes quite legitimate protests about things like the occasional misdeeds by a few of our police officers. But at the same time, central institutions like the Supreme Court are radically altering the meaning of gender. Loud, though not necessarily large, groups are calling for canceling, something we called airbrushing during the Soviet years, historic names, books, movies, and the like, and persons and organizations still with us. They are policing language with far greater brutality than the average police department, and as if they have somehow been given absolute authority. Now, many of these radicals are also getting riled up, to be sure, because of the November election, and they're doing what they always do, namely, using crises and manipulating institutions for political advantage. The Church is caught up in the middle of this maelstrom and is not very well prepared to deal with it, says Father Bramwell. Publicly, the Church has been wishy-washy about its social role and its own doctrine for decades. It did not protest strongly against the agnosticism and socialism growing in the universities, which has now spilled into the public square. It did not even react as some clergy and laity started supporting the political fringes spawned by these bad notions. The U.S. Bishops' Conference apparently does not even much work at uniformity among bishops, even as regards the most basic doctrines about God, man, marriage, you know, the important stuff. It's no wonder, then, that during the pandemic, most bishops just meekly followed civil authorities concerning Sunday worship. There was not much thought about the evils, both public and private, that are held at bay by the celebration of the sacraments. The general lack of conviction about authentic Catholicism has hobbled the Church in speaking prophetically during the public unrest and the global pandemic. Catholic, the word itself means universal, asserts that the Church holds the ultimate and universal truths about being human, being a married couple, and a basically just society. These truths come from or are derived from divine revelation. To be clear, this divine gift is not owing to the personal superiority of anyone in the Church. It stems solely from the fact that the Church is Christ's beloved spouse. Since these truths apply universally, all of the bishops need to hold them and teach them all the time, even during a pandemic, even in times of civil unrest. Just as there has been a weak response to the pandemic, there has been no coordinated episcopal response to the wave of Jacobinism that is shaking up the country. A high point in the history of such radicalism happened during the French Revolution, which is where this brand of political behavior picked up its name. The historian Simon Chama has pointed out that, for example, Jacobins violently attack any resistance they meet, particularly established authorities. They spread conspiracy theories and punish traitors, and they really punish them. They oppose freedom of speech in the public square and try to implement total control over financial institutions and establish numerous tests of political purity, which, by the way, are always changing in order to make a direct hit on the intended target. But back to Father Bramwell. Moreover, the Jacobins subvert existing institutions for their own purposes. Finally, as Shama noted, the Jacobins make their country ungovernable, which is their true goal. In the face of this phenomenon, the Church has an obligation to respond. During the French Revolution, Catholics died in their tens of thousands. There was not much they could do back then besides trudge on as martyrs in the face of the deadly violence. Of course, many Catholics fled France. Catholics in America still have a window to do something, but it's closing rapidly. Just as in France, the Cultural Revolution in America is approaching a fight over the fundamental principles on which the country is based. The difference in the United States, thank God, is that widespread killing has, so far, not started. And we won't easily let it. It is imperative that all people of goodwill now carry out the moral and intellectual fight for principles like life, truth, history, and law and order, a spiritual battle which cannot be won through coercion or violence. What our deeply divided episcopate can do at this juncture is anyone's guess. The bishops have chosen to be as poorly situated as possible to confront a serious crisis as this, and not only by their clumsiness and worse on sexual abuse. Their self-inflicted weakness as teachers of both faith and reason is already a handicap, says Father Bramwell. Their inability to come together as the custodians of God's truth, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, is approaching conditions of scandal. The bishops do not make up the truth, even as a group. They only pass on, or ought to be passing on, what they have received. Muddying Catholic teaching makes us look like just another of the dozens of vague Catholic sects in America. Americans, even Catholic Americans, sense that not a few bishops and priests don't have the courage to proclaim the gospel whole and entire, out of fear of our cultural revolutionaries. Every diocese and every religious order should be flooding the media with messages about the value of forgiveness, bearing each other's burdens, how we all fall short, and therefore need God's and one another's mercy, not least in our politics and social interactions. The alternative to that gospel message is political fanaticism, and as recent history shows, beyond question, that will not end well for anyone. Thank you, Father Bramwell, longtime teacher, writer, and dean at Catholic Distance University. This is the PRI review from the Population Research Institute at pop.org. Keep on listening. We'll be right back. Help the Population Research Institute and sign our petition to ban crippling contraceptive drugs. Your petition will help protect women from the horrible illnesses caused by one of the most widely used contraceptive drugs in the world. It will also help hand a crushing defeat to Planned Parenthood and the United Nations Population Fund. Now, this is why the petition is so critical. Right now, the Food and Drug Administration, known as the FDA, is actively looking at banning the contraceptive drug known as Depo-Provera. It's an injection drug that Planned Parenthood and the UN abortionists love because it's cheap, easy to inflict on women, and best of all, it's long-lasting. But Planned Parenthood and the UN refuse to tell us what medical research has proven about Depo-Provera. It often leads to transmission of HIV, causes blood clots, depression, anxiety, and the desire to commit suicide. That's not my layman's opinion. It's the opinion of top medical experts who have spent years researching and proving that Depo-Provera inflicts those horrible illnesses on many women who take it, At PRI, thanks to your past support, we have published 4 of those reports. So with the FDA actively considering a ban on Depo-Provera right now, is the time for you, me, and our fellow PRI supporters to put pressure on the FDA commissioner to outlaw this crippling drug. Your petition to ban crippling contraceptive drugs will do exactly that. Now, that petition is right at the top of our website at pop.org. Bear in mind, as you sign it, these true stories from women who suffered terribly from this contraceptive drug. In their own words, these stories are from women who suffered horrible illnesses. The Depo-Provera, one of them says, birth control shot severely disabled me. That shot messed my body up to the core. I am still struggling with depression, chronic fatigue, chronic infections, as well as about 20 other symptoms that I did not have prior to getting that shot. I'm 41 years old and disabled now and can barely get out of bed most days. If you can bear it, here's another woman's Depo-Provera story. I soon developed close to 30 side effects and was unrecognizable to anyone who knew me and to myself. I could no longer function as a teacher, mother, wife, daughter, friend, or person in general. These, my friends, are just 2 of the reports we have from women severely disabled by Depo-Provera. We have dozens more, but I'll spare you. So here's what has to be done and how PRI will do it. First, we must produce a video featuring stories of women who have been crippled by Depo-Provera, a powerful, moving story like the 2 I just told you. Our goal is placing this explosive video on the computer and phone screens of at least 100,000 viewers. Next, we'll create a special section on the PRI website that explains, in layman's terms, how Depo-Provera cripples women, even leading to HIV transmission. By the way, over 1 million people have turned to PRI's website. And then, with so many people educated and outraged, we will flood the FDA commissioner with our petition to ban crippling contraceptive drugs. And the FDA, by law, is required to pay attention to these petitions. We'll start with petitions from you and your fellow PRI supporters, and then we'll get petitions from at least 30,000 other pro-lifers across the country. This will be public outrage that is certain to grab the FDA commissioner's immediate attention. We have been successful in getting another dangerous contraceptive drug, Norplant, taken off the market in the U.S., and we can do it again. But we can't do it without your renewed support help. Please go to our website at pop.org and look for the petition right at the top of our homepage and sign your petition there. You'll be glad you did. Now we turn to a dust up on Capitol Hill, where a congresswoman has decided that good saints have no place in the Capitol Rotunda. Tim Carney, senior columnist at the Washington Examiner, tells us that St. Damien, who ministered to Native Hawaiians in a leper colony, is now a colonizer, according to Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She pointed to a Catholic martyr who gave his life to minister to the least fortunate Hawaiian natives. Probably knowing little or nothing about his life's story, she held up this saint and hero of Hawaiian history as the totem of white supremacy, apparently because he was an immigrant. Well, that's the most charitable interpretation of her tirade, centered on St. Damien of Molokai, one of the 2 men, the people of Hawaii, which is the least white state in the United States, have chosen to honor with a statue in the U.S. Capitol. As my colleague Beckett Adams wrote, Hawaii is represented in the Capitol by not just Damien, but also by King Kamehameha I, the indigenous ruler who governed the Hawaiian kingdom in the 1810s. Now, Ocasio-Cortez only obliquely tied the saint to white supremacy, but she explicitly called him a colonizer. The priest was nothing of the sort. He was an outsider, yes. He was born in Belgium. He crossed the oceans to get to Hawaii, and at his first opportunity, he asked to be sent off to Molokai, a leper colony. While there, according to the U.S. Capitol's website, he constructed a home for boys and later a home for girls. He bandaged wounds, made coffins, dug graves, heard confessions, and said Mass every morning. In December 1884, Father Damien noticed severe blisters on his feet without the presence of pain. As he suspected, the disease was leprosy, says the U.S. Capitol's website. Queen Liliuokalani, the very woman whom Ocasio-Cortez says they should honor instead of St. Damien the colonizer, wrote a letter in 1881 to thank him and to bestow an honor upon him. Here's the letter. Reverend Sir, I desire to express to you my admiration of the heroic and distinguished service you are rendering to the most unhappy of my subjects, and to pay, in some measure, a public tribute to the devotion, patience, and unbounded charity with which you give yourself to the corporal and spiritual relief of these unfortunate people who are necessarily deprived of the affectionate care of their relations and friends. I know well that your labors and sacrifices have no other motive than the desire to do good to those in distress, and that you look for no reward but from the great God, our Sovereign Lord, who directs and inspires you. Nevertheless, to satisfy my own earnest desire, I beg of you, Reverend Father, to accept the decoration of the Royal Order of Kalakaua as a testimony of my sincere admiration for the efforts you are making to relieve the distress and lessen the sufferings of these afflicted people, as I myself have had an occasion to see on my recent visit to the settlement. I am your friend, Liliuokalani, Regent. St. Damien died in his 40s of the disease he surely knew he might contract from caring tenderly and in person for those ostracized and suffering victims of the disease. So, according to Ocasio-Cortez, you are a colonizer if you lay down your life for people you never met before halfway across the globe. If you earn the plaudits of the local queen for your selfless heroism, you are a colonizer. But there's even more to the story. The chairman of Hawaii's State Statuary Hall Commission, Hawaiian-born Luis Lopez, was the chief advocate of memorializing St. Damien in the U.S. Capitol. The state lawmaker who sponsored the legislation to honor St. Damien with a statue was Hawaii-born Frank Liu. Were these non-white, native-born Hawaiian public servants colonizers? As far as St. Damien being a colonizer, well, Hawaii was never a Belgian colony. He wasn't there representing Belgium either. He was there representing the Congregation of the Sacred Hearts of Jesus and Mary. And when the question arose in 1967 that St. Damien was an immigrant and not a Hawaiian citizen, Senator Daniel Inouye, a Democrat, by the way, rejected such nativism, pointing out how other states honored non-citizens with their statue, the Honolulu Star Bulletin reported. The statue of St. Damien, chosen for the Capitol, was sculpted by a woman of color, Marisol Escobar, an immigrant who lived in New York and was renowned as a cutting-edge pioneer feminist sculptor. The blockish style of the sculptor partly emulated native totem poles. Her statue caused an uproar in part because it depicted St. Damien near his death, suffering in advanced stages of leprosy. At that time, that very human suffering struck some as out of place in the buttoned-up U.S. Capitol. So the statue Ocasio-Cortez objects to as a totem of white supremacy is a statue of a poor, sick, immigrant social worker to the poor whose work was honored by Hawaii's native queen, The statue was created by an immigrant woman who was a feminist artist of color and chosen by the people of the least white state of the Union. Now, to be fair, one columnist at Star Bulletin, Sammy Amalou, had a decent critique of the decision to put St. Damien in the U.S. Capitol. Now, keep in mind, Sammy wrote his columns from prison. "Poor old chap," Amalou wrote. "He had a hard enough life at Kalaupapa without adding to his agony by leaving him within earshot of the diatribes and harangues that punctuate each day's passing at Capitol Hill. What a fate to design for any statue. But to do it for a man who has already suffered so much for humanity's sake is certainly stark brutality beyond compare. Well, today that may be more true than ever. St. Damien of Molokai, pray for us all," says Tim Carney, and so say we. This has been the PRI Review from the Population Research Institute at pop.org. Be sure to go to our website at pop.org and sign our petition. And thanks for listening.